So for this week's little dharmets, I'd like to continue with the idea of stories, but this time to tell the stories of the Buddha from the suttas, from the ancient literature that we have in our tradition, that purport to be the direct records of the Buddha. And not some of the common stories that are often told about the Buddha, but rather some of the ones that contain some wonderful teachings. And some of these stories are not great stories, but they are stories that contextualize the teachings and can help them to stand out a little bit and highlight. And so the first one is a discourse. Discourse, is the ancient word is sutta. S-U-T-T-A, and it's called the Chanki Sutta, and it's spelled usually in English C-A-N-K-I, and it's number 95 in the Middle Length Discourses. And I'm particularly fond of this sutta, and when I teach some of the courses I teach on the suttas themselves, on these ancient discourses, especially when I teach courses on the Middle Length Discourses, I like to start with this one. And the reason for it is that the story pivots on, and therefore maybe the most important part of the text, is a teaching the Buddha gives on the preservation of truth. And how do we preserve the truth? And to offer that the beginning of teachings on this ancient studies of the ancient teachings, is how do we study these texts and preserve the truth as we do it, stay truthful in a certain way, and not to accept them naively, the teachings, not to accept them as true because that's what's in the text. How do we relate to these teachings if we don't have our own direct experience of them? And how do we talk about it? So the preservation of truth. And so the story has to do with Brahmins visiting the Buddha. And Brahmins were, and we have in this text a kind of, represents a little bit the tension in ancient India between the Brahmin caste and the, sometimes called the warrior or the noble caste, the Kshatriya or Kshatriyas, that the Buddha came from. And India was a very hierarchical culture. Everything was stratified according to hierarchies. And there was a vying for top position among the Brahmin class, which was often Brahmin priests, the priests of the Brahmanical religions. Some of them who were phenomenally wealthy and controlled lots of territory. And then the warrior, noble class that were often the rulers. And so in this text, the Buddha's camped out near a town where there's a Brahmin named Chanki who's phenomenally wealthy. He's been given land. It's like a medieval lord, you know, given by the king a whole big territory to be his own, and to the wealth of it was his. The people in it were working kind of for him and things like that. And he's also very learned in the Brahmanical lore. And one day he hears about the other Brahmins in his town hear that the Buddha is nearby, and there's a good report about the Buddha. He's supposed to be, a wonderful teacher. And so they all decide to go visit the Buddha and hear his teachings. However, there's a group of other Brahmins, 500 it says, visiting the town from other places, and they get upset that Chanki, this kind of ruler of the territory, this great Brahmin, is going to go visit the Buddha, and they say it's inappropriate for you to visit the Buddha because you are so wonderful, and they go through all the ways in which he's wonderful, the Buddha should come see you, because you're so elevated, and you shouldn't go to the Buddha. And the Brahmin Chanki says, oh, no, no. The Buddha is actually more wonderful. He lists all the special qualities of the Buddha to argue, yes, it's appropriate for me to go see the Buddha, not the Buddha to come to me. So they all go to see the Buddha, and they're sitting there having a conversation about the Dharma or something. And there's a 16-year-old Brahmin priest, a student of the Brahmanical lore, teachings, sacred texts, who's sitting amongst them, and he keeps interrupting the Buddha. And at some point, the Buddha says to him, and exactly the tone of voice and how he said it, we don't know, and how to translate the word into English, we don't know. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as the Buddha rebuked the boy for interrupting the conversation between the elder Brahmins and himself. One meaning for the word is that the Buddha stopped, just simply stopped the Brahmin, the young boy, the 16-year-old, and said, you know, you shouldn't interrupt when the elders are speaking. And then one of the elder Brahmins, maybe Chunky, says, oh, it's okay, Venerable Buddha, that this young man is one of the most learned of the Brahmin students we have. He's memorized all the ancient texts and the histories of the past and philosophy, and he knows it all. Please, it's okay that he is part of the conversation. And in the very formal, polite culture of the time of the Buddha, probably what the Buddha needed to do in order to have converse with the 16-year-old, he needed to have clear permission from the elder Brahmins to do so. Otherwise, it would be rude to them that he directed his focus to this 16-year-old. So he has that permission. So the Buddha looks at the 16-year-old, and 16-year-old says, oh, good, the Buddha is now ready to hear my question. And the 16-year-old says, it's been said among the Brahmins that our texts, our sacred texts, are the only ones that are true, and everyone else is wrong. The Brahmins say that definitively our texts are the only ones that are true, and everything else is wrong. So they're kind of definitive. This is clear. And what does the Buddha think about this? And the Buddha, in these kinds of circumstances, does what he often does, which he asks counter questions. And he asks the 16-year-old, the student, is there any Brahmin in the current generation who has directly known and seen the truths of these ancient texts? They really know it for themselves through their direct experience. And the student says, no. And what about their teachers, the generation before them and the generation before them? Did any of them say they directly knew and saw the truth of these teachings? No, they never said they directly knew it themselves. And if you go back 7 generations, nope, no one 7 generations has said they directly know and see for themselves. And if you go back to those people who composed the sacred literature, did they ever make a claim, maybe in the literature, that they directly knew and saw the truth for themselves? And the student said, no, there's no proof that they claim that they themselves saw it directly for themselves. So then the Buddha makes a kind of a big claim, statement. He says, sound seems to me that the Brahmins are a little bit like... Well, before I say this, earlier in the text, Chanki, when he's describing the great qualities of the Buddha, he says the Buddha never harmed any Brahmin. And so this, what's about to be said, could be seen maybe a little bit offensive, but maybe there's a way of understanding it that it's not offensive, but it's just, just doing kind of an Aikido move with the conceit or the arrogance of this student who believed that this is the truth that he had. And so the Buddha said, it's what you're saying then, it's kind of like a row of blind people, one holding the shoulder of the next. The one in the front can't see, the one in the middle can't see, and the one in the back can't see. And the Brahmins are a little bit like that, like a row of blind people going along. So the the student then says, well, you know, but we have it on faith. We don't know and directly know and see for ourselves, but we have it on faith. And the Buddha says, well, what's known on faith may be true, but it might not also be true. There's no certainty about just because it's taken on faith that it's true. Ah, but it's in our oral traditions, in our texts. And the Buddha says, well, just because it's part of the tradition, it might be true, but it might not be true. There's no way of really knowing just because it's traditional. And then the Buddha says there are five things that may or may not be true. Things taken on faith, things taken as being true because we like them, we prefer them, things taken as true because they are the tradition, things true because we've reasoned them out for ourselves, they're logical, and the last one is because there's some kind of intuitive understanding of we intuitively feel or sense that these are true. And he said, in each of these circumstances, sometimes it might be that it's true and sometimes it's not. And there's no way really of understanding which it is based on those sources. And so the youth says, well, how do we preserve the truth then? And this is the pinnacle of the text and why I like it so much. The Buddha says that we preserve the text by stating the basis upon which we make a claim. So if we take something on faith, we say, it is my faith that this is true. If we take it upon our preferences, it's my preference that this is true. If it's based on the tradition, the texts or something, our teachers or something, then we say, it's based on the tradition, this is what the tradition says is true. And then I reasoned it out for myself. That's why I think it's true. Or I just have an intuitive sense that this is true. And so we're not making a claim about what is true. We're making a claim about how we've come to understand what we think is the truth. We're not claiming it's true. We're claiming that we have faith or reasons to believe it's so. And then it's possible to be in dialogue with people. People understand what we're basing our claims upon. We can go back and look at the text, or we can examine their reasoning, or we can appreciate the faith that someone has. And this idea of really being clear about the basis upon which we take something to be true. It's my interpretation. It's my this or that, as opposed to claiming it's true. This is the pivot of the text. Then the student says, well, if how do we discover the truth for ourselves? And the Buddha then goes on and says, well, in that case, if you want to discover it for yourself, go find he actually says a monk, a bhikkhu, who's come to your village or something, and spend a long time checking that person out, that teacher out. Make sure that that person doesn't exhibit any traces of having greed, hatred, and delusion that might skew how they talk about the truth, where they might be motivated to twist or bend the truth a little bit for the purposes of their desires or their aversions or their delusions. So really check someone out first. When you're confident that they don't seem to exhibit any kind of greed, hate, and delusion that would maybe skew how they give the teachings, then listen to their teachings and reflect on them and really take them in and think about them for yourself and find out what's going on. And then once you really have reflected on them deeply, then engage in the practice and do it wholeheartedly. Enter the practice into the world of the direct experience until the direct experience opens up that you discover the truth for yourself. And then the Brahmin student says, well, is that all there is, just a discovery? And the Buddha says, no, there's one more step, and that is the arrival at truth. So not just discovering what the truth is, but arriving at it. Now what the Buddha is doing in talking about the discovery of the truth, he's kind of doing another move by Aikido, at least this is my interpretation. I'll say that so I preserve the truth. And that is, he's saying that what he's doing is he's rather than talking about an abstract truth, he's pointing the student to how you could practice to experience the direct experience that Buddha values the most. And it's through practice that that's accomplished. Mindfulness practice, concentration practice, and all this. And then once you have the discovery of truth, then to arrive at truth, the Buddha says, well, then you do the same thing over and over again. You do repeat the same practice repeatedly, again and again, until it gets you're fully integrated into it. Then there's no separation between yourself and the truth. And you, in a sense, become the truth. It doesn't say that in the text, but become the truth. So, and so then everyone's happy. And that's the end of the story. So it's not necessarily a great story, but it's a fascinating story of setting up the context for why it's so important to emphasize the preservation of truth among people who hold on to the truth out of faith or out of traditional reason or something. And there is another way of going about it, which is not just to take teachings, even Buddhist teachings, on faith or because it's in the texts and therefore it's true. That's always provisional. That what's not provisional is when we've actualized it for ourselves and really, oh, this is what I know. I've experienced myself, the direct experience we have ourselves of it. Now I know. And then we can arrive at truth by keep practicing what we've discovered. So that's the story. And I hope that you appreciated that. And I'll tell some other stories for the rest of the week. So, thank you.